The latest book from Bill Richardson, the former governor of New Mexico and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is part memoir, part instructional guide, based on conversations he's had with some of the toughest and most powerful people in the world, people like Fidel Castro, Saddam Hussein, and Kim Jong-un. He joins us now to discuss how to get the impossible accomplished with his co-author, Kevin Blyer, an Emmy Award-winning writer and veteran of The Daily Show. Their book called How to Sweet Talk a Shark is published by Rodale Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Bill Richardson and Kevin Blyer back to our shows. Welcome back.
Thank
a pleasure
you,
to be here.
Great to
a
be
pleasure
back.
To be here.
And Bill, after reading about your prowess as a negotiator, I was a little nervous, so I've left my wallet and valuables in my office.
That's not enough, I assure you.
Well, did you, Kevin, negotiate for yourself when you committed to writing this book, Bill?
I don't know that I'm getting paid a cent to help him out. He's very good.
We were just talking about that. He got, you know, there was a little money there that he forgot.
We left
about,
on the table, as it were.
He left on the table.
Bill, how do you define the term shark as you apply it to your counterparts across the table?
Well, the way I define it, Leonard, is difficult people, dictators, bad people. President Clinton used to say, "Send Richardson, bad people like him." And so I would go and try to get either hostages out or a ceasefire. But what I'm trying to do in this book, and Kevin is the one, I'll give him credit, is how does this relate to when you're negotiating with a dictator? Like if you've got a tough negotiation buying a house or with your wife or your spouse or your son or daughter, how do you relate to people? How do you engage? The first is build confidence. Find a way to relate to the other person culturally with a dictator. Use a little humor. I use humor all the time.
So you try to break the ice when you start.
You got to break the ice because the good news about negotiating with a dictator is if you make the deal with the dictator doesn't have to go to Congress or get approval from somebody else. You've actually won. And so it's important to relate culturally to I always go to North Korea or Cuba, go where they want to be, let them be comfortable. I don't think that's much of a concession.
And the adage is true. Starve a cold, bring Governor Bill Richardson to break a fever. He's the one who knows how to set the right mood from the outset.
But when you met Saddam Hussein in the Iraqi desert, he got up almost immediately and left the room.
That's because I screwed up, Leonard. I crossed my legs when we started the negotiation, showed him the sole of my shoe, which is a supreme insult to an Arab. And he stormed out. And I looked at my translator and I said, "Am I a goner? What do we do now?" He said, "Well, you insulted the president. You must find a way to apologize." I said, "Well, is he coming back?" "Well, he came back." And you know, Leonard, I didn't apologize. I gambled. I said, "He's trying to intimidate me." And
it's a way of getting the upper hand by
get
walking
an upper
out.
Hand. And he came back. And I think he respected the fact that I didn't grovel or apologize. I was very respectful. But he had those beady eyes looking at me. And in the end, we established the personal connection. And he turned over the two Americans.
And he actually made a little joke with you at the end of the negotiation.
Yeah, he said, "Well, you know, we're going to bring the media in." And by the way, he said, "Mr. Congressman, this is not good for me to be photographed with you." And I turned to him. I said, "Well, Mr. President, it doesn't help me in New Mexico or in the U.S. to be photographed with you." So both of us cracked a little smile.
That's not the only joke, in fact. As you recall, before you left, he said, "You know, you were planning to go to church, aren't you?" And you said, "Yes, I will." And as I recall, he said, "Well, do me a favor, don't go to confession because it'll take too long knowing you."
He said that. And so
that was rather witty.
It was witty.
Well, I guess we should assume he wasn't stupid, even if he was ruthless.
And another lesson, Leonard, is when you get what you want, and I had the two American prisoners, you get out. You leave because they change their mind. Dictators do that. And he said, "No, no, you said you'd go to church. I've arranged for Tariq Aziz's wife, who is a Chaldean Catholic, to take you to church."
Now, Kevin, yes. In working on this book, You must have been concerned about making it different from the other books on negotiations that fill the business bestseller list.
Well, I actually didn't have to be too concerned because I think, as you've gathered, I really just had to draft on him. He was telling me so many rollicking anecdotes that I knew that this is where the bread and butter of what is going to be both amusing and informative about it is truly just sit at his knee, almost transcribe these things, and find some way to retell it in a way that really brings out the absurdity of a lot that has gone on.
And as somebody who has written for Jon Stewart and Bill Maher and others, do you find yourself putting yourself in their place, trying to capture their voice?
Oh, I'm pacing around my office. Not only I'm doing my best impression, for that matter. You do your best. Exactly right. All you can do is kind of spend as much time as possible with these people. And I have had the fortune to travel around the world with the governor. We went to North Korea. He sent me to Cuba, a couple of the places.
So did you watch him in negotiations in North Korea?
Oh, indeed I did. We spent a good 6 days there. Negotiating with a lot of people. I mean, obviously, we were all drafting on him, as it were, and watching and admiring what he can do.
Was it surreal, as people say?
Well, North Korea specifically is quite a place. It is like landing on the moon with people already on it. Not to mention there's a time warp, as you've often said. You feel like when you land, you've gone back 40, 50, 60 years.
Now, earlier in your career, you worked at the Public Theater and worked with Anna Deavere Smith.
Oh, my, I did,
so that was...
You do your research, sir.
But that had to be a lot of perfect preparation for doing this kind of work.
You know, it was, because I spent months transcribing interviews with Anna Deavere Smith and a number of people in different communities and different, you know, events that had gone on in the 90s. And I saw what she did. I saw how much she inhabited the characters that she played. And she would rehearse ad infinitum, late into the night, line by line, getting a sense of what their intonations were, what their voices were, what their attitudes were. And I'll be honest with you, I hadn't actually thought it through that far, but that was probably the perfect training ground for something like this for the last 15 years of this kind of work.
Now, Bill, how will this book be useful to the average Joe who probably won't find himself across the table from a crazed African dictator or an Egyptian torturer?
Well, I think, Leonard, in daily life, like negotiating with a girlfriend, I think what is the advice? One, have credibility. Know where you want to end up at the end of the debate with a girlfriend. Use some humor. Let the other side save face. Set a deadline. Where do you want to end up and when? Find ways to use humanity. You know, one of the things that we do in foreign policy negotiations, there's scripts and very formal and here are the talking points, and you're a bad person you're negotiating with. You don't want to do that when you're negotiating with a dictator. In a tough situation, a difficult situation, find ways to relate and have the other person have confidence in you.
But in your description of the things that you think you should enter the negotiation with, I immediately applied them, of course, to what's going on in Washington right now, and none of those things seem to apply.
Well, what I would do right now, Leonard, in Washington, and no one's going to ask me or care what I think, but I do.
What do you think?
I would do three things. I think they need a mediator. They hate each other too much. I would bring in Tim Geithner, Henry Paulson, ex-secretaries of the Treasury that know budgets, taxes. Second thing is I think there's already an outline of a deal. Take Obamacare off the table.
The House Republicans, it just was announced, are refusing to do that.
Well, I think that they're going to go to the brink, Leonard. The second thing I would do is test them. Test the Tea Party guys on a vote, and Boehner can do that. Find a way that there's a deal where the shutdown ends, you go till February on the debt limit, some deal that involves spending cuts, entitlement reform, and tax reform. I think that's the outline of the deal. The last thing I do, Leonard, is president should call everybody into the White House, say, you guys are not going to leave until we make a deal by Thursday. Put pressure on them, keep them away from the media, keep them away from their caucuses, and try to make the deal.
And then send them all to confession as a last ditch.
We always follow Saddam Hussein's advice when we're negotiating. We're talking with Kevin Blyer, who is a co-author with Bill Richardson of a new book called How to Sweet Talk a Shark. It's published by Rodale Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post over the weekend, Bill, you suggested that Congress should take a lesson from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since the war in its eastern area seems to be unstoppable, isn't that pretty harsh judgment?
Yeah. I mean, I meant in the sense that both sides
More people have died in that war than the people died in World War II.
Maybe it wasn't a good comparison. But actually, Kevin came up with, no, I'm kidding.
Throw me under the bus.
But this is based on your negotiations with Mobutu?
Yeah. You know, my job was to tell Mobutu, the United States isn't supporting you. You got to get out. Kabila's coming in. We'll give you safe passage. He had this cane. I thought he was going to hit me with a cane. He was so mad because he had been supporting us. Well, we moved him aside. The point there is that in the Congo, there's such intractable negotiations that my suggestion was the way you negotiate in the Congress is bring mediation. You can't have the same parties that hate each other, that are living with each other, that are right now in intractable positions, continue these negotiations. But no one's going to listen to me. They'll try to figure it out without mediation.
Well, part of the problem is doesn't a successful negotiation require both sides being willing to bend, but there are also situations where one of the sides is making unreasonable demands.
Well, that's right, and that's the Tea Party Republicans. But there are moderate Republicans in the Senate, in the House, and one of the things that I would do if I'm the Speaker is test these 30 to 40 Tea Party guys in a vote, and I bet you some will peel off. Let there be a clear vote. And Boehner, I don't think, wants to do that because he probably loses his speakership.
Well, in Congo, so you negotiated, Mobutu did leave, and it turned out the man who replaced him, Laurent Désiré Kabila, was almost as bad a dictator
as
the guy you got back in there.
Yeah, that's a small detail. But it's true, Leonard. He came in. He was going to win anyway. He was going to overtake the country. And then what happened, he was assassinated.
So it's just a matter of convincing Mobutu that he had to be realistic.
Look, you're going to lose. We don't want a massacre in Kinshasa. Get out. But he came in, Kabila. Then he was assassinated by his own guards. And now his son, I relate in the book, 12 years later, is president now.
And you were sent there to
and
help
I was
forestall
sent
the
there
civil war.
To, yeah, there were as a presidential election, another civil war. I think the fact that I came helped things. I won't take credit for ending the civil war, but the Congo relationship to the Congress is that, you know, right now both sides are in intractable positions.
Kevin, how did you and Bill first meet?
That's a good question. How did we meet?
I wanted somebody vigorous, vibrant to write this book, somebody with his credentials, I mean, The Daily Show, Bill Maher, somebody that can relate and write. And, you know, he's a hilarious guy, but he's enormously talented. He made this book what it is with his ability to write. I can't do that. You know, politicians, Leonard, we write good memos and, you know, we screw up speeches. So I wanted talent, and I got it. I probably didn't pay him enough.
If you can tell out there, I'm blushing.
Well, you've been here before for things you wrote. Did you not really write them?
Well, no. Leonard, I have a ghostwriter. I told the stories to him, and we spent hours together, but he put them together. No, you know, most authors, they come in here, politicians, they say, oh, yeah, I wrote it. You know, I was in a computer. They don't. I'm admitting I didn't.
Well, the book is more fun.
We all want transparency, and he's offering transparency right now.
The book is more fun than any book I can imagine about negotiating with despots should be.
Spectacular. Oh, I see. Backhanded compliment. There we go.
Well, let's talk about your background, Bill. Your name isn't Spanish-sounding, but has that made your life a little easier?
It has. I think the fact that I was raised in Mexico, my mother only spoke Spanish to me. My father, when he spoke to me, would speak to me in English. He was a tough guy, my father. He was very demanding.
A banker.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was raised in a bicultural background. And then when I was elected to Congress, one of the things that drove me towards negotiations is I used to have these town meetings in my district, the district of a lot of Native Americans, Hispanics, Anglos, and there were always like contentious issues over land, water, environmental issues, animals, horses. I'm trying to save some wild horses right now in my spare time. And so I try to bring people together at those town meetings. And that led me to negotiations. And then I started doing some in Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi, moving her into a situation where she was in prison but house arrest, a lot better.
As long as you didn't swim to meet her, everything's okay.
That's right. That's right. But, now we have a very good Aung San Suu Kyi and I, our foundations work together.
You say that you're the good cop and the bad cop rolled into one. Was that something you learned from watching your parents?
Well, yes, but also, when I'd bring some of the Native American and Hispanic landowners in a dispute over water, you know, there's no good cop, there's no good or bad guy, but there's a good cop and bad cop. And I try to, you know, with humor, bring them together. But in the end, I said, look, we have to resolve this or we're going to have the land in a bad situation. And they would resolve it.
He can both break the ice and bring down the hammer, as it were, yes.
Well, going back to that time that you showed Saddam Hussein the bottom of your shoe, aren't you briefed on the things that are going to cause trouble? I mean, later, Nelson Mandela insisted that you dance at the end of a negotiation in Congo.
That's right. That was quite a show. And Mandela, just by his mannerisms, by his stature, he was a great negotiator. But yes, Leonard, I made a mistake in that Saddam Hussein negotiation. I had my briefing books from the State Department that said, don't show the soles of your shoe. But I was so tired, and Saddam brought me in to negotiate. He knew I had just arrived, and he drove me straight to the presidential palace. You know, I hadn't slept for hours. We'd been driving from Jordan. So that's another trick of dictators. They don't tell you what the schedule is. They try to get you tired. They try to get you irritable. And then they negotiate and try to, you know, bleed you to death.
You say that you have a lot in common with Fidel Castro.
Well, you know, he was, of all the people I've negotiated with, he was the smartest and most interesting. I'll tell you why. He used to read 10 newspapers before he woke up. And he was a guy that worked
at night. Before he woke up?
Yeah. That's right, because he would work at night. Mm-hmm. And he'd listen to television, radio, so he was superbly informed. He also thought he knew everything about American politics, which he didn't. He was very hard-headed. But at the same time, we connected because we spoke in Spanish and we liked baseball. And I try to break the ice by saying, you know, Mr. President, I just went to a baseball game. Cuban baseball, you got great hitters, but your pitching isn't too good. It was like 9-7. He got mad at me, but we related in a way.
He had been a pitcher himself.
He'd been a pitcher, and then, you know, with Jesse Jackson.
He said you went to the wrong game.
That's right. You know, Jesse Jackson had just gotten 25 prisoners from Castro, and I said to him, look, I'm asking you for 5. Come on. You going to give the black guy more than the Hispanic guy, your guy?
And that worked with him?
That worked. He laughed and laughed. I ended up with the prisoners I wanted.
You know, I'm going to get a lot of angry mail because you said that, but that's another matter.
No, I know. I'm being honest.
Hugo Chavez, another one you got along with?
I got along with
you
him.
You get along with a lot of awful people.
Well, I'll tell you, with
Well, they
Chavez,
call, as you know, they ultimately started calling him the undersecretary for thugs because he was able to speak to these people and actually have a conversation and get what he wanted out of them. So in the 90s, that became his reputation.
But I would assume that part of the reason for your success is that you didn't You humanize these people because then the natural inclination is to dehumanize them.
Right.
You go into a negotiation thinking, this person is a thug, an awful person.
Well, Chavez, and you mentioned him, Leonard. He was a pitcher. And so to break the ice, I brought him a baseball signed by Mickey Mantle, Duke Snyder, and Willie Mays. And that really broke the ice because he said to me, and I'm going to make some people in Brooklyn mad. He said, well, you know, Mickey Mantle was a lot better than Duke Snyder. Why are they in the same baseball? I said, well, I don't know. But Willie Mays was just as good as Mantle. And so that broke the ice, and it led to us relating to each other.
Well, if you knew anything about Brooklyn, you'd also know that Duke Snyder is in the Hall of Fame along with Willie Mays
sure.
and Mickey Mantle.
But he
they
wasn't
were three
as good
great,
as Mickey. He wasn't as good as Mickey.
Well, no, it depended on what borough you lived in. As a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, I always thought Duke was the best. It was only later that I realized that Mantle and Mays were quite extraordinary. My guests are Governor Bill Richardson and Kevin Blyer. We're talking about Governor Richardson's book called How to Sweet Talk a Shark, which is published by Rodale. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Kevin Blyer and Governor Bill Richardson. The book, How to Sweet Talk a Shark, is published by Rodale. Now, you were ambassador to the UN. Why are you Governor Bill Richardson rather than Ambassador Bill Richardson?
Governor is the title. It's not written in protocol that you keep after you have a position like that. Although I know a lot of people that have been ambassador, they keep the title forever. I was Secretary of Energy, Congressman. But governor is the one that has the most stature.
Really? More than ambassador?
I think so, yeah.
In some of the negotiations you describe in the book, you were in an official and sanctioned position as the UN ambassador or acting officially on behalf of the State Department. But for some of them, you were a free agent. Is that anything like Dennis Rodman going to North Korea?
Yeah, you know, I'm a little jealous of Rodman. He got in to see Kim Jong-un, and I didn't. I went with Eric Schmidt at Google.
Well, he knows more about basketball than you do.
He knows more
about baseball than he does.
That's fair enough.
Right. Yeah.
It's true.
But I think what happens, Leonard, is, you know, you sometimes out-of-the-box diplomacy is important. The State Department official people can only do so much because of strained relations. And when you're not in power but have some capacity, you can still get something done.
Well, but so that's the advantage of being a free agent. But you don't have the authority to speak on behalf of the government. And usually some government spokesperson makes that clear.
That's right.
And they say, we have not sanctioned this visit by Bill Richardson.
That's right. And that happened to us in North Korea.
Right.
Does that undermine your credibility?
No, but it doesn't help. Right, Kevin?
I think that's fair. And that message gets across the world. It's true.
You know, and we thought that we had a new approach to North Korea that involved, okay, we're going to try to get this American release, Kenneth Bay. Secondly, they should stop their nuclear efforts and their launching missiles. And then we thought with Eric Schmidt, bring the internet, talk about the internet in North Korea.
And there were plenty of opportunities that. We looked out in that.
You know, I think our message was well received and the trip was worthwhile. But there were some instances, like when I was out of government, Leonard, that I screwed up in a negotiation trying to get this American Alan Gross out of Havana. And I screwed up because I got mad. I was not thinking properly. The Cuban said, we're not going to not only turn them over to you, you're not going to see them. So I got ticked off, and I walked out of the negotiation, went to the Nacional Hotel, where a bunch of press were waiting, hundreds of press. And instead of, like, cooling off and going to my room, I said, you know, this is a hostage, and the Cubans are being unreasonable. And I'm not going to leave until the Cubans turn them over to me or I can see them. And that was a big mistake. And 4 days later, I had to leave without Alan Gross.
Well, you tell a number of stories about embarrassing news conferences
following
failed negotiations.
Right.
In one case, you embarrassed Bill Clinton.
Well, yeah, I did. And I regret it because it ended our relationship.
Because you had been his protege, hadn't you?
I had. Well, he made me ambassador to the UN. He made me Secretary of Energy. And I ended up in the presidential race, which I was in very briefly, endorsing Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton. And Bill wasn't happy because he went to New Mexico to watch the Super Bowl with me to try to convince me to endorse Hillary.
He assumed that you would, and then he's going to tell the press, well, and Bill Richardson's with
because
us.
You had accepted the invite. So he assumed he was going to be able to.
So I should not have accepted him coming. But what do you say to a former president? Hey, you can't come and watch the Super Bowl. He was my pal. But I regret it because the relationship is breached. You know, it's not good. We say hello to each other when we see each other. But, you know, he was important to me, and he's ticked off, and I understand it, and I shouldn't have let him come to have the press conference in New Mexico or watch the Super Bowl.
Well, this kind of shows that even if you are very adept at diplomacy, sometimes you could be undiplomatic.
That's right. And, you know, emotions run wild. And I told him, I'd endorse you, but you're not running. It's your wife. I like her. But I think there's something special about this Obama guy. And I don't regret that I endorsed him. But, you know, it ended or breached the relationship.
Now, getting back to North Korea, you went with Eric Schmidt to a country that famously doesn't allow people to have computers. But didn't you go through a room where there were a lot of people on computers?
Yeah. Kevin can tell the story
Indeed.
Better than
I do. We went to the e-library at the Kim Il-sung University. And there were certainly a lot of computers. There were two rooms with at least 150 monitors there. It was a fascinating experience, as you can imagine, because we walked in not knowing we were about to enter this room, and we were talking somewhat loudly to each other. We walk in, and these students who were there, exactly 150 students at exactly 150 terminals, didn't even seem to be interested in this cacophony that walked in to pick up their heads and look at us. So there was a question about whether or not they had been told to say, you know, stay on task. You're there to suggest to the world that we have this internet connectivity, and so don't let anything distract you.
Now, is North Korea the hardest country to negotiate with? Because it seems to me that we often come to agreements with them, and then it doesn't really lead to anything.
It's the toughest, Leonard, because they don't think like we do. In a negotiation, there's always a quid pro quo, a give and take. The North Koreans don't believe in that. Their idea of giving in is, okay, we'll give them a little more time for them to come to our position.
Is Ted Cruz a North Korean?
I don't know the guy, but geez. But my point here.
I suppose that would
here,
explain a lot. I don't know.
But I think about the internet. Eric Schmidt, when he went with Google and the North Koreans, he was a star. They were really interested in him. The students, the software engineers, the government. I mean, he fascinated them. And I think the view is that if the internet expands in North Korea, it's right now used by some very limited government people, that if it expands, it'll allow the North Korean people to see the advantages of liberty and democracy. And I think the regime would be in trouble. And this is why they contain it. Nonetheless, the academics there, the professors, the kids, they were fascinated by Google and what Eric Schmidt was telling them and what was possible through the internet.
Can you talk a bit about going to Egypt when Mubarak was under attack?
Yeah, I remember going, and that's another area where you break the ice. I was meeting this man named Suleiman, who eventually was vice president.
But not Mubarak himself.
I did meet Mubarak. And with Mubarak, you know, I remember talking to him, and I made some joke. I said, you know, Mr. President, you might want to think about an election. He says, I've had an election. I won 92%. I said, no, you know what I mean, like a fairer election. And he said, they are very fair. Anyway, I didn't tread too much there.
But, Kevin, sometimes humor doesn't translate well.
Well, in this case, I think it did, actually. Not that case, but when we met with Omar – I say as if I was there. I feel like I was there because I heard the story a few times. As you are on your way to meet with General Omar Suleiman, who is fairly notorious, I think we can all agree, your cohort, Mr. Mickey Bergman, was joking on the way in the limo, where are we headed? We're headed to the place with the dungeons. So when – the governor arrived, and he said to Omar Suleiman, Mickey told me there'd be dungeons. Where are the dungeons? So not only did that joke work, but I think Omar Suleiman might have appreciated the humor in throwing one of his cohorts under the bus.
No, but in that negotiation, we were trying to – there was this Israeli named Shalit. We were trying to get him out. Suleiman was a mediator in that. And so it worked well. Suleiman loosened up after I made that dungeon joke.
But you hung up on him practically in mid-sentence when you
I did because I got the answer I wanted. If you ever watch the movie Moneyball with Brad Pitt, he's trading somebody over the phone, and he gets what he wants, and then the other general manager's about to say something, and he hangs up, and then Jonah Hill says, "Okay, you know, you hung up on him." He says, when you have the answer you want, hang up on him. That's what I did with Suleiman.
And you say one of the rules you follow is when you get the victory, go fast.
Leave. That was like in North Korea when we got a prisoner out with Saddam Hussein. Get out. Once you get your – because they could change their minds, or there may be something in the press that makes them change their mind.
And by the way, traveling with Governor Richardson, I think, is the only time you'll ever hear the phrase, that dungeon joke, which is what he just said a moment ago.
Now, who was Paul Salopek, and why was he being held in Sudan?
He was a Chicago Tribune journalist. He was traveling with two Chadians, and he was writing very critical stories about Bashir in the Sudan, who is considered the world's worst dictator, most cruel dictator. And he was imprisoned there. And his wife and Salopek, they lived in New Mexico. So they came to me and said, we know that you've succeeded in the Sudan 12 years ago with some Red Cross workers. Can you help us with Bashir? So I underwent those negotiations. I went to Sudan. I took the Chicago Tribune editor with me. I took the wife with me. And we met with Bashir. And the fact that I had been with Bashir 12 years ago, I'd respected him and I praised him for giving me these three Red Cross workers in his country. That helped a lot. So that helped in him agreeing to release Salopek, which he did, but he didn't want to release the two other Chadians that Salopek had that were carrying his equipment. And I said to him, you know, you got to let me release these guys, too. He said, no, just Salopek. These Chadians are enemies of the people. I said, look, it doesn't look good. And Leonard, you're going to get some mail on this. I said, these are two black guys. I can't leave with just the white guy, Bashir. And he looked at me and he started laughing again. It was like Fidel Castro. Okay, you can take them. You've got them. Get out of here. And we did.
So you managed to get Salopek and the two Chadians out because dictators and despots think you're a great guy?
Well, they think I've got a sense of humor, or maybe a pathetic sense of humor.
Yeah, I didn't mention the fingernail joke.
That's right.
You want to
tell that one, Kevin?
Well, I'll have to leave that to the governor.
Well, that was the same thing with Suleiman. I said, you know, did these guys still have their fingernails that you've got
did
in
he
the dungeons here? Well, at first he didn't laugh. He stared at me. Then he looked around at his staff, and they started laughing, and he started laughing. And
the key there is you have to discern their sense of humor rather than yours. Yeah, Meet them more than halfway.
Sometimes you have to break the ice because you've only got one meeting. This guy runs a show. You know, it's either going to work or it isn't working. So far, this humor has worked.
Now, there's a big debate these days over whether we should negotiate with Iran.
Right.
Barack Obama got a lot of heat during the last presidential campaign for suggesting such a thing. Do you have any suggestions as to how to approach negotiating with Iran?
I think he should do it at a level that he's doing it. I think he's doing the right thing with Secretary of State Kerry. Talk about some areas like Afghanistan we can work together. But I think the key is going to be, will the mullahs let Rouhani negotiate on reducing or terminating enriched uranium and nuclear weapons? I think that has to be tested. I'm not optimistic, but I think we have to pursue these negotiations.
Well, isn't part of the problem the UN, where you were an ambassador, for example, in dealing with Syria, there are certain things you just can't get past?
Well, the problem, you're right, Leonard, is that the Russians and the Chinese can veto any kind of military operation, peacekeeping, because there are five members of the Security Council, and there are two of them. We, the French, and the Brits usually stick together, but the Russians can veto. And that's the leverage that they have. With Syria, I think we've ended up in a good situation where they have to get rid of these chemical weapons, but there has to be oversight. There has to be verification. But what I would like to see is that these negotiations, the Russians realize that Assad is a loser. He has no support in the country. He's got the military and the establishment. That maybe the next phase should be a negotiation for a political transition.
Governor Bill Richardson, his book written with the help of Kevin Blyer.
Ambassador Kevin Blyer, by the way.
Oh,
if the governor isn't using it, I shall.
It's How to Sweet Talk a Shark, Strategies and Stories from a Master Negotiator, published by Rodale. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
My pleasure.